Members, we will call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. If members could please come in and take their seats. We have a rather full agenda today. We're already a few minutes behind, so we're going to go as quickly as we can. And we are going to start off with Representative Loon, the first one on the agenda, House File 2544. Representative Loon, if you want to go ahead and move your bill and get it properly in front of us, and then proceed when you're ready.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move adoption of House File 2544 to be passed and sent to the General Register.
As far as I know, General Register. I have not heard otherwise. Thank you, Representative Loon. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this bill deals with the regulation of travel insurance, and generally this is insurance that consumers would have the option to purchase when making a purchase of travel, perhaps a cruise or something else. And the bill really emanates from some National Association of Insurance Commissioners review, and as you know, they often review practices and issue guidelines and suggestions for some uniformity of insurance across the states. And so this the legislation really stems from some of those efforts. And with me today is Mr. John Fielding, who represents the United States Travel Insurance Association, who can talk about the details of the bill. Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment. And I don't know if you wanted to do that now or later.
Yes, let's do that now. I've been looking for the amendment here. Got it right here, the A1 amendment. If you want to go ahead and offer the A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would offer the H2544A1 amendment.
Okay, and you want to give us a brief outline or sketch of what the amendment does?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this relates to compensation of travel agency employees and that if the travel agency offers insurance. And just I think Mr. Fielding will get to the point of what this covers and why it was important to do this in discussing the bill.
All right. Mr. Fielding, if you want to identify yourself for the record and tell us why we need the amendment and the bill, and we appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you very much for having me and allowing me to speak today on HF 2544. My name is John Fielding. I'm with Steptoe & Johnson, and I represent the U.S. Travel Insurance Association. On behalf of USTIA and our members in Minnesota, I urge you to support the legislation. The legislation would modernize the licensing process for limited lines travel insurance producers, for folks who sell travel insurance. It'll thereby reduce regulatory burdens with essentially a really workable solution to the current licensing problems that exist not only in Minnesota but across the country. As Representative Loon said, the NAIC and NCOIL, the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, have both been looking at this for a number of years, and the legislation that you are considering is consistent with standards set by the NAIC and a model that is under consideration by NCOIL right now. It's also been fully vetted by industry players across the country, independent agent groups, and others. The legislation would essentially do two things. First, it would update the definition of travel insurance to reflect more accurately what the coverage includes and what it does not include today. In many states across the country, definitions of travel insurance still include references to things like steamship travel and things like that. And so this is an opportunity to fix that in legislation. Secondly, the bill will reform the licensing process itself for people who sell travel insurance. It establishes a registration process for travel, for what we call travel retailers. Those are travel agents, not insurance agents. And these are travel agents, essentially, who offer and disseminate travel insurance under the direction of a licensed MGA, insurance agent, or insurance company. What the amendment would do would be to clarify that the compensation from the travel agency, from the licensed entity, would go to the travel agency itself and not to the individual travel agents. It leaves it up to the travel agency how to compensate its own employees. It also then it thereby deals with an issue of compensation, because individual compensation leads to a licensure requirement under current Minnesota law. So we wanted to make sure that that was not incorporated or impacted by this amendment. And that is it in a nutshell. We really think that the legislation protects consumers while providing for a straightforward licensing process that allows licensees, licensed entities, as well as retail travel agents to comply with all applicable requirements in Minnesota, as well as other states, for the uniformity that's really important to allow us to work in a nationwide and worldwide industry. Again, we urge you to support the legislation, and we thank you for considering our views. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fuley. Members, any questions on the amendment? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak for or against the amendment? Seeing nobody come down, we will vote on the A1 amendment? The A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. The bill is now in the shape that the author would like it. Representative Loon, do you have anybody else that wants to speak to this? Members, any questions? Anyone else in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against the bill as amended? Seeing nobody, Representative Loon renews her motion that House File 2544, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Loon and Mr. Fueling. Representative Woodard, House File 2003. I will, and members, while Representative Woodard is coming down, we now have enough people to be here officially and have a quorum. We have two sets of minutes again today. We're still catching up with a technical difficulty from about a week ago. Representative Stensrud, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from yesterday, the March 20th meeting?
Yes, I have. I'll move those.
And Representative Stensrud moves the minutes from yesterday, March 20th. Any questions on those minutes, members? Seeing none, all those in favor of the approval of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The minutes for the March 20th meeting are approved. And Representative Stensrud, you're on a roll. Let's try the March 14th minutes as well. Representative Stensrud moves the minutes for the March 14th meeting. Members, any questions about those meetings? And I believe after this we are all caught up and we'll only have one set of minutes per meeting. Seeing no questions, those in favor of the approval of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The minutes from March 14th meeting are approved. With that, we're relatively back on schedule. Representative Woodward, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2003 so it is properly before us. And Representative Woodward, tell us what it is and why we're here and what we need to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2003 would allow for the ongoing operations of the Racing Commission, the State Lottery, and the Gaming Control Board. This is a result of the previous shutdown in which Canterbury Park and Running Aces, our horse tracks, were shut down as part of the state shutdown. And unfortunately, the money was there for the regulatory oversight because this goes into a special revenue fund. So there are no general funds that actually help support the regulation of the lottery, of the Gaming Control Board, or of the Racing Commission. So this would just allow for those ongoing operations. They would use a special revenue fund that's actually filled prior to any state shutdown. This has a dramatic effect, especially on our horse industry, where we've got Minnesota-bred thoroughbreds who are, this is the only racetracks they can race at. And when you shut it down, they really don't have the opportunity to move to other locations. So this is why this is before us today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Woodard. And members, this is before us because of the gambling control issues. And Representative Woodard, Representative Nelson has a question. But before we get to him, just to make sure this is, and I am, as everyone knows, a Racino fan, but just to reassure the committee, this is not a vehicle and not going to become a vehicle for any Racino or other gaming legislation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am a closet Racino supporter myself.
Representative Woodard, I'd like to say I'm out of the closet. So, come on, folks, I thought that'd be funnier.
I thought it was very funny, Mr. Chair. This is not a Racino vehicle bill in any way, shape, or form. In fact, I have testified before previous committees that if any sort of amendment were to be put on this in the House floor and it moved forward, I would pull the bill.
And Representative Woodard and members, I didn't say this at the start, and I meant to. We got this bill from Ways and Means. We are assuming it passes. We are sending it back to Ways and Means. We just wanted to have it make a stop here just to talk about the because it does mention gaming in the title of the bill. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did hear this bill earlier in government operations, and Representative Werder probably is going to know what I'm going to ask here. But in the past, this is just another one of many bills I saw in government operations this year dealing with putting government on autopilot for different pieces of it. And I know we've had these discussions in the past. I know former Speaker Swigum used to rail against these about talking about putting government on autopilot. And I guess this, like I said, we've seen a whole bunch of these in government operations. And I know there may be some valid points as to doing this overall for all of government, but there's been talk about that. But like I said, we've seen a lot of these piecemeal, and I just don't, it's like we're preparing for a shutdown 2.0, and I don't want to go there.
Representative Nelson, I couldn't agree with you more. I like this particular bill, and I'm casting a very skeptical eye on the rest of those provisions because I don't think it's in our best interest to put everything on autopilot. And that is a good point and well made. Members, any other questions? We have Mr. Kruger here from the Racing Commission if we need him, but seeing no questions, is there anyone in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against this bill? Seeing nobody coming down, I will renew my motion that House File 2003 be recommended to pass and sent back to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Woodard, and good luck at Ways and Means. With that, we are on, I believe, to Representative Creasel, Senate File 1599. Representative Creasel, welcome to the committee. I will go ahead and move Senate File 1599. If you could, whenever you get settled, go ahead and start and tell us about your bill and why you're here and what we can do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have it as House File 2100. I believe it's the same. It's the veterans' preference. It's the same language.
We are, the official position of this committee is we would much prefer to work off the House files whenever possible. So we like that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2100 is a bill that would permit any private employer to grant preference in hiring and promotion to a veteran, as well as the spouse of a disabled veteran who has a service-connected permanent and total disability, and or the surviving spouse of a deceased veteran. This is something that simply, it doesn't mandate it on private businesses. It allows them to grant this preference without any potential lawsuits or repercussions. Mr. Chair and members, I have Jerry Kaiser here to give a brief testimony on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Creasel. Mr. Kaiser, welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the tape, please proceed when you're ready.
My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm a Vietnam disabled combat veteran, and I'm also the vice chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council, which represents the 381,000 world veterans in the state of Minnesota, and their families are even more than that. So we wholeheartedly support this. With the change in the mix of the military, losing 100,000 plus our 3,000 coming back, we want to give these outside non-governmental agencies and companies the opportunity to hire veterans and not get sued by somebody because they're violating a so-called civil right of some other one. So that's my say, and I as a disabled veteran like John, I applaud this kind of bill.
Thank you very much, that was well said, sir. Members, any questions? Is there anyone in the audience, anyone else that wants to speak to this bill, either for or against it? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that, members, I did say, and it is true that we do prefer House files, but we are working off of the Senate file just to make sure we get all our ducks in a row. I will renew my motion that Senate File 1599 be recommended to pass and go to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Creasel. And, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Which one am I doing, the wine festival? Okay. Take over.
Next bill on the agenda is House File 2932. Mr. Chairman, if you'd move that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 2932. It is a bill that I don't know if technically we're going to lay this over or how we do this, but I think technically we lay it over and then incorporate it into the with the will of the committee approves it, incorporated into the omnibus liquor bill. And I know there are at least a couple of people that want to come down and speak on this, but it's a pretty simple bill. I can't remember if we heard this in committee last year or if we just talked about it. We didn't hear it in committee last year, but it was talked about. Essentially what it would do is let wine festivals, and I'll just read the change in statute because it's short, it would let at a wine festival, they would be able to sell off sale by the bottle with a limit of 6 bottles, provided that no more than 6 bottles may be sold. And that's really it. It's just allowing wine festivals to sell some of their product at the festival. It's pretty simple and straightforward. That does not mean it's without controversy. I think Mr. Bagnoli wants to come and tell us a little bit about that. And I'd be happy to answer questions while Mr. Bagnoli's coming down, or he can answer some.
Mr. Bagnoli.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I'm not sure if there's anyone. I didn't know of anyone that wants to speak in favor of the bill. If there is someone here, I'm not aware of it, but I'd be happy to have him come down and help me out.
Okay.
I don't look panic-stricken enough, I guess.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli with McGranchet Law Firm on behalf of the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association and Minnesota Municipal Beverage Association. First, I want to say, frankly, the folks that, surprised they're not here, are usually the farm wineries, Minnesota farm wineries, that care about this provision. I think care about this provision. In any case, we've had a strong relationship with the farm wineries and have really tried to support them, and had regional meetings at many of the farm wineries, have sponsored the most recent wine stroll, which is sort of their annual convention. We have some concerns about this bill. We think it's a big departure from the current way that things are done. Right now, currently, you can only buy alcohol for off-premise consumption from a liquor store or a farm winery, or in limited cases from a brewery. And all of those are fixed and known locations. They're all structures where they're fixed and known. This is a step towards creating a floating liquor license for a wine festival, for a floating liquor store license. We have some concerns about it. We believe, we've been told by the Minnesota grape growers that they are not pushing that this year. Perhaps this is why they're not here. That's it.
Any questions from the committee for Mr. Bagnoli? Yes. Or to the bill author on the bill? Anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? All right, hearing none, the bill will be held over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members and guests, we were going to do next was going to be House File 383, Representative Hamilton, but I believe he's in another committee right now. When we see him, we'll jump back in order. So we will go to Representative Bills, unless he's hanging out with Representative Hamilton, which is possible. Representative Kiefer is going to do the Bills bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Representative Kiefer. Thanks for pitching in.
Okay, I would like to move House File 2894 to be referred to rules.
Yes, that is true.
Okay. And before we get started, I'd like to do an oral amendment to align the language with the Senate version and remove sections 2 and 3.
Okay. Members, does everyone understand the amendment? We are, Representative Kiefer is removing sections 2 and 3 of the bill. Any questions on that?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cove. What does that do to the rest of the bill?
The second Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What's the effect of that, I guess, is
Representative Nelson, I checked with Senator Thompson, who's carrying this bill in the Senate, and the reason they deleted it is because it was really just cleanup language for other sections of the statute that didn't really do have anything to do with the purpose of the bill. And so in order to streamline it and get it onto the floor as soon as possible, they decided to take that out.
Representative Nelson, does that cover it? Members, other questions about the amendment? Representative Nelson.
Not the amendment, the bill.
Well, with that, I think rather than asking if people want to come down and speak to the amendment, because I think that will greatly change the bill, and I suspect we're going to have a lot of people that want to come and testify on the bill. With no objection from members, we will go ahead and vote on that amendment to get it in the shape that the pitching in author wants it to be in, and then we'll move on to the bill. With that, those in favor of the oral amendment to House File 2894 signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Representative Kiefer, now the bill is in the shape that you would like it in. Do you want to explain the bill a little bit more, or do you want to have people come down at this point?
I would like to ask testifiers that are for the bill to explain the purpose of it.
Please come down. And ma'am, if you could identify, whenever you're ready, if you could identify yourself for the record, and then tell us why you're here and why we should support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Wendy Wolf. My husband is Dan Wolf. He was a sergeant in the Minneapolis Police Department, and he was injured in the line of duty in 2005. He has a brain injury and requires some supervision for both cognitive and mental health reasons, as well as has double vision, and he's permanently totally disabled, unable to work. And I am his caregiver. I have been his only caregiver for the past 7 years. I have never been allowed any respite during all of that time. Apparently, there is a loophole in state law that if you are permanently totally disabled in the line of duty, after 2 years have passed, the city only has to pay a grand total of $25,000 in wage loss under the work comp system, because the pension offsets the workers' compensation, so the city is let off scot-free. They don't have to pay anything. You only get your pension and nothing else. Under the current system, if you are injured to where you can go to work in another job, say you work at a store or in an office or whatever, you can get your pension and the wages from your new job and any workers' compensation payments that you're due up to a grand total of 125% of what you used to make before there's any offset at all. But if you're permanently totally disabled, you get 60%, and that's it. And yes, it's tax-free, but you, when you're injured in the line of duty, you never make it to your peak earning years. So it's not the same as going all the way through a career and getting your 60% pension and going on maybe doing another job at age 55. So it creates basically a system where if you are injured in the line of duty and you can't work, if your pension isn't enough for your family to live on, the only way that you can take care of your family is to die. And in my husband's case, he tried to commit suicide in 2007 because he thought, at least then I could go get a full-time job because I wouldn't be his caregiver anymore, and we'd have his life insurance and the family would have a chance of being taken care of. Mary Liz Holberg, Representative Holberg, took up this issue in 2008 and tried to fix this loophole, and it died in committee. Then she created a special pension classification for my husband where instead of 60%, he gets 75% of what he was making. But as I said before, he never got to his peak earning years. It's only been 7 years since he got hurt, and his pension now is a little bit over half what he would be making if he was still working today. He's 47 years old. He was 40 when he got hurt. So 7 years later, what is supposedly a 75% pension is just over a 50% pension. And when you include the increased out-of-pocket health care costs that we have, it actually puts us at half or thereabouts of what he would be making if he were working today, which is a very difficult situation for a family to be in. That provision was a temporary measure to try to give time to come up with a permanent solution to this problem, because I don't think anybody intended for permanently totally disabled officers to have the least support of anybody who gets injured in the line of duty. This is an attempt to come back and fix that loophole. It has gone through the Workers' Compensation Advisory Committee, and they're not doing a bill this year, but they gave their blessing to this bill to try to fix the problem.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Members, any questions?
Chair.
Representative Nelson.
My question I had would be for Representative Kiefer. She serves on the Workers' Comp Advisory Commission. Do you, and that was the question I had, that did this go through there, and did they vote for it or against it, or where does it sit? Where does it sit there? Because normally workers' comp things go through there first before they come mm-hmm. to the legislature.
Representative Kiefer.
Mr. Chair, it did go through the Workers' Comp Council, and who's over here to testify to that? Okay. Oh. And I'm going to just, for the record, have someone from the okay. who's a voting member.
I think that's probably a good idea. Sir, if you could identify okay. yourself for the record, and please give us your perspective on this. We'd appreciate it.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32, and I speak on behalf of our 62,000 active members in the state of Minnesota, many in the law enforcement field. As a member of the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, I can tell you that we did have discussion with regards to Mrs. Wolf's issue, and I believe what we had concluded is that we wanted it fixed. We are absolutely.
I'm sorry. You wanted this particular case fixed.
We wanted this particular okay. issue fixed.
Thank you.
And we are absolutely comfortable with the direction in which this bill takes it. I would like to briefly comment with regards to the issue, and offer our support for the bill itself, if that's appropriate right now, Mr. Chair.
I think it is, but let's check. And could you spell your name for the record to make sure we get it?
R-E-Y
okay.
N-O-S-O. Okay. See, if I put S-K-I at the end of it, it'd be no problem whatsoever.
No, it's it actually, what there's a weird acoustical thing here, and sometimes we get a lot of different names wrong, so I always forget to ask okay. to have it spelled, and then I get nudged.
It's quite common.
Well, Representative Nelson, do you want to ask another question here, or do you want to let Mr. Reynoso?
We could let Mr. Reynoso. That answers my question, this
okay.
question.
Mr. Reynoso, go ahead. I think this is a good time for you to shed more light on this.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. Every day, our police officers and our firefighters put these uniforms on. They are risking their lives. It's unlike any other position, any other job that someone may have. I just want to throw out a few statistics that I think really brings this issue to light, brings this issue to the reality of what it's like to be a cop and a firefighter. Every year, 150 officers on the average are killed in the line of duty. Last year, there were 173 officers killed. Every day, 150 police officers are assaulted on our streets, protecting us. Every day, 10 are shot at. Those are statistics that are real, and statistics that our police officers live with. Every day they put that uniform on. As far as our firefighters, according to the U.S. Fire Administration, from 1980 to 2010, 3,660 firefighters have lost their jobs. Lost their lives protecting us, fighting those fires. And when we pick up 911 and call them, they come out to save us. Now, as tragic as 9/11 was, even if you take out the firefighters that lost their lives on 9/11, it's still 3,210 firefighters that lost their lives. Now, police and firefighters they're unique in the way that in most cases, as the Teamsters Union representative, there's so many cases where our members have the opportunity to say no when it comes to performing some type of job or task. If one of our drivers in the trucking industry jumps into a truck and sees that the truck is unsafe, by law, they're protected by law to deny to drive that vehicle for the sake of saving the general public, protecting the general public, and themselves. Officers and firefighters don't have that option. When they receive a call, when an officer receives a call that there's a shooting scene, they don't have the option of saying, give me the next call. That one's unsafe. I don't like that call. When a firefighter gets a call to go fight a fire, that firefighter doesn't have the option of saying, give me the cat in the tree stuck call. They have to go to these jobs. They have to go to these calls, and they don't have a choice to say no. That's why I believe, and our organization believes, there should be exceptions to the rule. Now, it's real simple for us. We believe that we have a responsibility. The responsibility to our firefighters and our police officers that put their life on the line every single day. We rely on the police officers and the firefighters to save us. And we do have a fundamental responsibility to make sure we do the same in protecting them and their families when they put their life on the line. In my opinion, in our opinion, there is no legitimate reason why we should abandon our responsibilities to them if we continue to reach out to them as we will always do. So we encourage that you strongly consider supporting House File 2894. We believe it's the right thing to do, needs to be done, and I believe it would be good for the firefighters and the police officers that risk their lives every day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Reno. So, members, any questions? Representative Kiefer, do you have anyone else that you want to have come down and testify in favor of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I saw John Rakowski wandering around, but now I don't see
he'll
him.
He'll probably wander back. That's what he does. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess got a couple questions here, partly because in a few years back, I helped Representative Holberg pass special legislation through the Pension Commission that helped out this officer and their family. And I'm just wondering here if this provision that's in here, is this a one-time for this officer only? Is this special legislation, or is this for all police officers all the way across the board?
Good question. Representative Kiefer?
I'm going to have to ask Ms. Wolf maybe to come back up, please, Mr. Chair.
Welcome back, Ms. Wolf. Can you shed some light on that for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that the current House version does not address our personal situation. It addresses people going forward that were to be injured in the line of duty. The House bill has been amended to be neutral as to date of injury,
okay,
so that it would cover our family as well as anybody else who fell through the same loophole that we fell through. That's led to significant numbers of people who are opposed to this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Wolf.
Well, thank you, Ms. Shea. I don't want to sound like I'm being hard on the police officers or that, because right, actually my former partner was that I had when I started as an apprentice in the Carpenters was a his brother was a Minneapolis police officer shot in the line of duty. So I have great sympathy for police officers and firefighters. I just want to make sure that, like I said, we passed legislation in the past through the Pension Commission to help Officer Wolf, and I just want to make sure that we're not, this isn't a continuing thing that we're coming forward just for one person and one person's injuries. I guess I don't oppose to the bill, but I just wanted to make sure that we knew that was on the record.
Good point, Representative Nelson. Ms. Wolf.
If I could clarify, Mr. Chair, originally when Representative Holberg tried to pass the legislation in 2008, she was trying to do it for everyone, and they were not willing to get it through committee unless it was for one person. And then I had a promise from Mary Vanek from PARA that she would look at what is the totality of the issue and come back with a fix or a report of options to fix the problem in the future, and that has not happened.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. I know there are a couple of other people listed that wanted to come and speak to this. Mm-hmm. Laura Kushner from the League of Cities, if you want to come up and tell us what, give us your opinion on this bill.
welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and start when you're ready.
Thank you. My name is Laura Kushner, and I'm here representing the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm the HR director there. I would like to first say that it is not an easy thing for the League of Minnesota Cities to testify against a bill like this. We represent cities. Cities employ police and firefighters. We believe in what they do, and we respect what they do. However, this bill will result in a very substantial change in how the workers' compensation law is applied in Minnesota. And I think it's extremely important for this committee to understand that change. Instead of receiving 66 2/3% of their pre-injury wages, under this legislation, an officer who qualifies for this will result in or will receive more like 126% of their pre-injury wages tax-free. Currently, the system is designed to make employees whole and to get them back to work whenever possible. We understand that that's not always going to be possible for an individual to get back to work, but the system is designed to have an incentive for employees to get back to work and to be made whole. It is not a good idea under a workers' compensation law to have a strong financial incentive for employees to seek a permanent total disability status in order to receive a higher level of wages than when they were working, and also to have that higher level of wages be tax-free. I can't speak to Mr. Wolf's claim. It would not be appropriate, nor do I have access to the details of his injury or his claim. But I can say that under current law, an officer in a similar situation would be made financially whole. Again, the current law allows for 2/3 of their salary to be tax-free. That is intended to get them as close to their pre-injury wages as possible. In addition, they are eligible for the same health insurance contribution as active police officers at the city. So if I am injured in the city of Rosemount or Bloomington or any other city, I would receive the same health insurance contribution as active police officers. So there are laws in place to protect these officers and to make sure they are kept whole. The other thing I would like this committee to know is that we looked at three claims that will be affected by this legislation that are very representative of this kind of injury. Those claims will cost an additional $3 million for our insurance trust. Each claim will cost about another $1 million. We also have looked at 19 total claims that are likely to be, or that if this type of legislation was made retroactive, as it was in the Senate version, there are 19 claims just in our insurance trust that will likely result in about $24 million. The insurance trust is not a private sector insurance company. All of the premiums that are paid to us are paid by taxpayer dollars, by cities, and these increased costs will go to property taxes eventually, okay? The cities will pay more in work comp premiums, and they will have to pass that on to property tax holders or property tax owners. The other thing I would like you to know is that I am just speaking on behalf of the Insurance Trust of the League. This does not include the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, Rochester. We don't speak, or we're not, I'm not, the claims that I'm talking about don't cover any of those entities, nor do they cover the counties. So we are only talking about a portion of the claims that are potential under this bill, 19. Okay, there are many more out there as well. We believe this bill is just being rushed through too quickly. We need time to study this issue and to see what the long-term effects will be. We have only known about this bill, or we have only had the actual bill in our hands for about a week. In addition, I'm a little surprised to hear that the Work Comp Advisory Council is in support of this, because we are not able to see any minutes on their website or any record of them having heard this and come to a decision on that. The last thought I want to leave you with, if I could, is that this bill reminds me so much of the health insurance bill for police officers that was passed in 1997. A very, very well-intentioned bill. At that time, we had law clerks that went and pulled the testimony from 1997. The testimony said this will only affect a few officers, a year. It's not a big deal. It won't cost a lot. By 2003, it affected 145 officers and $1 million in city's additional expenses just in that 1 year. I can't tell you over the life of it how much it has cost cities, millions of dollars. The testimony is it would only affect a few people and a few, you know, a little bit here and there, and it ended up, we spent years trying to get it back down to the original intent. I just don't want to see this happen again. We need to study this issue. We need to have a good understanding of what impact it's going to have on our cities and on property taxes. This creates a strong financial incentive for these employees to be classified in a certain way under work comp law. When you create that kind of financial incentive, the numbers change. We need time to study that, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kushner. Members, any questions? If not, I believe Mr. Carlson also wanted to come up and speak to the bill. Thank you, Ms. Kushner. Mr. Carlson, welcome back to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record and start when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association that consists of 13 of the larger counties. I also appear in opposition to this bill. I fully support that we need to honor and provide adequate remuneration to the individuals who are hurt in the line of duty. I believe the existing system already provides that remuneration. I do first want to make clear to the committee that while this bill as it stands right now only affects permanently and totally disabled members of the PERA, Police and Fire Plan, who are receiving a disability pension since June 30th of 2007, the exception that is being made is a provision that applies to, frankly, every recipient of permanent disability benefits under workers' compensation. If you will look at the bill on lines 114, continuing on to 115, you will see at the end of line 114, the benefit paid by the employer shall be reduced, and this is the important information, the amount of any disability benefits being paid by any governmental disability benefit program. Again, this applies to every recipient of permanent total disability benefit under the workers' comp system. Clearly, it applies to members of the PERA police and fire system, but applies to the members of receiving disability under any of the state's pension systems. But more importantly, what you have to realize is this applies to all those individuals who formerly work for private employers who will generally be receiving Social Security disability income or SS, or as well as in some instances SSI. So what you're providing an exception to right now applies to only a narrow class, but I guarantee you if you do it for this that others will be here next year saying me too, because we've seen this happen again and again. Has Representative Nelson inferred, I've passed out a document. Some additional compensation was already provided to Mr. Wolf back in 2007. At that time, a separate permanent and total disability benefit was created in the PERA, Police and Fire Statute. For general recipients of the disability benefits, that benefit stops when they turn age 55, when they can go on to a normal retirement disability. For those who are permanently and totally disabled, the disability benefit continues for life. And that benefit is at a minimum 60% of their high five salary, and to the extent that they work more than 20 years, they receive an additional 3% for each year beyond that 20 years. For the initial individual who was affected by this, they're receiving a benefit right now of 75% of their high five and are receiving compensation after tax greater than what the individual received when they were employed full time. As Ms. Kushner said, also these individuals receive compensation in terms of continued employer contribution to their insurance cost, in this instance for life. Again, for other PERA, police and fire disability recipients, that benefit cuts off when they reach age 55. For these individuals, it continues on for life. So they've already received significant compensation. I do want to make it clear this is not just Mr. Wolf. PERA says there are seven individuals that qualify for this right now. I also want to make it clear that this is not covering the universe of PERA police and fire disability recipients. This only applies to those who are totally and permanently disabled, who can engage in no gainful employment whatsoever. Other PERA police and fire disability recipients who cannot engage in their prior job are not covered by this. But again, once you open up the door, they're certain to come back, as are members of the state patrol plan who are on disability benefits, and all the other pension systems. And ultimately, if you keep on this log rolling, every disability recipient is going to say, me too. And at that point, you will be costing employers tens, probably hundreds of millions of dollars. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll end. I do want to make it clear that just for the seven individuals that we know that qualify right now, this will cost local employers at least $5 million. It's not inconsequential, but the what you're setting in motion here by opening up the door on eliminating the offset will ultimately, if you pursue it to its ultimate fruition, cost Minnesota employers tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any
Thank
questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson, I understood this bill was not retroactive, so anybody that's currently on disability would not be included in this bill. Am I incorrect in that?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand the bill as it's drafted right now, it says this section is effective the day following final act and applies to all future payments to members of the Public Employees Retirement Association, Police and Fire, regardless of the date and injury. By referencing subdivision 1A in the operative language in clause B that's on page 2-6, basically you're only catching those who became disabled or applied for disability after June 30th of 2007. But that is going to be a growing population. It's not just one individual.
Well, Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, generally on these issues, I just got beat up for an hour and a half in civil law or however long it was, because they thought that it would affect a court case that's ongoing, which it clearly did not. So I can't imagine that we would do something retroactive like this. Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Pender, is there a fiscal note on this? Does this cost the state or is this just local? Or Ms. Newman?
Ms. Newman.
Is Representative there any cost to the state here, Mr. Chairman?
Representative David is wondering if there's David's is wondering if there's any cost to the state, if there's a fiscal note or anything like that.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am not aware of a fiscal note and whether a fiscal note has been requested on this bill. And the other item is the House version of the bill does not have is silent on effective date.
So, Representative Chairman, Ms. Numa, so then as Mr. Carlson described it, he'd be correct that it would pick up previous situations.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson, could we have a situation here where you could make more money on disability than you did on full-time employment? Is that possible?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Davids, absolutely. I believe Ms. Kushner basically went through this. The basic or the minimum disability benefit right now for PERA, police and fire, is 60% of their high five. Okay. And then workers' comp benefit for generally these individuals would be 66% of their pay. So right now, basically, they're not stacked. They offset each other. So you're giving them at least 60%. And again, to the extent they've worked more than 20 years, it goes up by 3% for every year beyond that. Now, with the elimination of the stacking, you're creating a situation which, at a minimum, basically gives them 126% of pay. And again, that's all pre-tax, or there is no tax on the disability benefits. So they're in a substantially better position than they were when they were employed.
Representative Davis.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Carlson, in a normal situation, if you're working and you make $30,000 in a year, let's say, your work comp benefit might be 60 or 66%, but that's tax-free. So now you're saying that there's 126% tax-free?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, for the particular individuals that are provided by this bill, they would get their PERA, police and fire pension, which is 60% of their high five, and then in addition they would receive the workers' comp benefit, which is generally for these individuals 66% of their salary. So again, adding the two together, at a minimum, tax-free. It's 126.
Representative
Davis. It is tax-free.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is amazing. First of all, that you'd go retroactive, and I agree with Mr. Carlson, this could set a situation where this would cost employers hundreds of millions of dollars. You cannot have a situation where someone is better off, and it's a very sensitive subject, I understand that, but financially you cannot set up a system where somebody is better off on disability than they are at full-time work. Because then all of a sudden, I'm not saying in any certain case here, but what studies find is that what you have then is you have a rush to permanent disability, and that sounds cruel and mean and terrible, and I understand that. But that's what happens. And so, members, Mr. Chairman, members, I am very concerned about what this bill does.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I was listening to your testimony, and I'm not sure if I misunderstood you, if I did understand you, if I misheard or did hear correctly. Could you repeat the part of your testimony you were talking about, what exceptions or additions would qualify under this? Because I thought you started to go on to say that this wasn't just limited to police and fire, but was open to Social Security recipients and so on. Could you repeat that part of your testimony, please?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, what I was saying that on starting on towards the end of line 1.14, the exception that you're creating is one of general application. Every beneficiary of permanent and total workers' comp has their benefit offset by governmental disability payments, and that includes Social Security disability. For you right now are carving out a narrow exception for PERA, police and fire disability recipients who are totally and permanently disabled. So it's relatively narrow right now. It is possible, depending on whether those individuals have had employment in Social Security covered employment, that they'd be receiving both PERA, police and fire. But if their whole career has been PERA, police and fire, that's a non-coordinated plan. They don't receive Social Security.
Mr. Chair, when
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Carlson, could you have a situation where if you had, let's say, 10 years under Social Security and then 20 years under PERA, let's say, that you could get work comp, Social Security, and PERA?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, it is possible, but again, the offset is basically giving you essentially one bite at the apple. You receive whatever is the minimum under the other programs in this situation, it could be both PERA disability and Social Security. Both of those would go to offset the workers' comp benefit. And that offset starts when the individual's benefit reaches $25,000.
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, not if this bill passes.
Not if this bill passes, that's correct.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, Davids. If this bill passes, you could have Social Security, PERA, and work comp.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mullery.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to help my friend from the largest sheet music entity in the world understand a little distinction. Representative Davids, there's two possible distinctions between what you're talking about and the bill that you just got beat up on and the this retroactivity bill. And okay. The first one would be based on the author on that bill. The second one is the distinction between we often do pass retroactive bills. We don't pass bills retroactive when they're already in the court system. There's a distinction there.
And thank you, Representative Mullery. Representative Davids.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery. Very seldom can you go, and I understand that the problem was the author in the earlier committee, but very seldom do we're pretty sensitive around here about retroactivity. Has it happened? Yes, it has, but very seldom.
Members, we are 4 minutes past my self-imposed deadline for this bill, and I know there are other people that want to testify, and I have other members here that have questions. And I think what we're going to do, if the committee's okay with it, is we're going to lay this bill over. I would hope that the committee would join me in encouraging the two sides and representative bills to get together and try to come up with some kind of a conclusion, and we can bring this back up tomorrow or Friday or whenever we next meet. I think we're relatively close, but I know there are concerns on both sides. So if Representative Kiefer, if you and Representative Bills and Mr. Carlson and everybody can get together and try to get us somewhere close to peace in the valley, we would greatly appreciate that. Representative Kiefer.
Mr. Chair, thank you for giving us the time to hear this bill. Thank you, Mrs. Wolf. We have one more person that wants to make a comment.
Well, Mr. Rakowski, are you commenting on whether or not we should lay this over?
Point of clarification from earlier testimony.
Well, okay, Mr. Rakowski.
The Work Comp Advisory Council, I just wanted to make a point of clarification. Yes, John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry.
Mr. Rakowski, for Mr. Reynoso's benefit and for ours, could you please spell that?
Sure, Rajkowski. My father would be happy for me to pronounce that too. The testifier was just in the Senate earlier, and as you know, there's four members of the caucus represented at the council, and Senator Lilly may have led the impression that the council approved of this bill going forward. Well, they approved of the bill going forward, but they didn't approve the bill. This is important nuance there.
Well, that's Senator Lilly.
That's all I have to say about that.
We've had our own issues with the Lilly family.
Yes.
Thank you,
Chair.
Mr. Rakowski.
So that helps, actually.
That does help, and I hope that we can reach some kind of a conclusion. I think all of us agree with what we're trying to do to help police and fire, but I think there are concerns with the scope and breadth of the bill.
So, Mr. Chair, I would change my motion and ask that the members vote to lay over this bill.
That we don't even need to vote on that, Representative Kiefer. We'll just lay with that. And we appreciate your indulgence and your time. And with that, House File 2894 is laid over, and we will take that up either tomorrow or Friday, whenever we next meet. With that, we will go to Representative Hamilton. Representative Hamilton, sorry we kind of jumped out of order on you. House File, I think it's 383. And I will move House File 383, so it is before us. And I think we have the DE2 amendment. Is that correct, Representative Hamilton?
We do have an amendment, I guess.
we like that kind of certainty here in Commerce.
What the appropriate amendment is. That's not the one that I was given, but...
Okay. Well, if it's... I mean, we're happy. You tell us which amendment we should be looking at here.
I want to use the appropriate one here. It would be, yes, it would be the DE2 amendment, there,
okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Members, I will move the DE2 amendment, and Representative Hamilton, can you shed some light on the whatever you want to tell us now, the bill, the amendment, the deal. And we are the committee, and I'm going to steal this again from Representative Davids. We do like peace in the valley, and we appreciate you and the proponents and opponents and advocates and people on all sides getting together and coming up with a deal. So if you want to tell us what we need to know, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that's precisely what we're looking at, working with, like you said, members on all sides of this issue. The DE2 amendment is the agreed-upon compromise, if you will. And we do have members here on all sides of this issue that are willing to testify, say a few words as well, Mr. Chairman. But in a nutshell, the first part of this talks about how this does not apply to the necessary relocation of the Radiation Oncology Center there in Maplewood and Woodbury as far as the movement there. The next part here, August 1st, 2014, is when the moratorium is lifted, and then the additional criteria is put in place here. And that would be, it'd have to be controlled or common control with a hospital that is licensed. The new radiation facility needs must be located at least 7 miles from an existing one. Any referring physician must disclose if they have financial interest. Then on 2.11, there's a few definitions there. The section does not apply for the relocation or construction of a facility that remains or owned by the same entity as long as it's located within 1 mile of the existing facility. And there will be a study of the radiation therapy facility's capacity for the current treatment capacity and the present need for radiation therapy. That'll be done by the Commissioner of Health. And like I said, Mr. Chairman, we do have members that are shaking their head. What I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, just have them come down and speak to the compromise language. I think... Mr. Chairman, all sides may not be entirely happy, and so it must be a decent compromise.
Thank you, Chair Hamilton. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your brief testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Irving Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R. I'm a retired medical oncologist, having served Minnesota cancer patients for more than 40 years. I represent Minnesota Oncology, which is a physician group of more than 50 trained cancer specialists, radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, surgical oncologists. We're the largest provider of cancer care in the state. Our primary goal in this issue is to promote access to care for Minnesota citizens afflicted with cancer. We view the existing moratorium in the construction of radiation therapy facilities as seriously adding to the already awesome burden on cancer patients. Consequently, we support the proposed compromise, which finally ends this onerous moratorium in 2014. Nevertheless, we do have reservations about the amendment, in particular about the proposed 7-mile limitation on new facilities, especially as it relates to the metro area, as to whether that's really realistic. That said, this is a compromise, and we accept it as such. We applaud the exemption for Health East to develop a new radiation therapy facility in Woodbury as finally providing the citizens of that area access to care. But we are disappointed that the legislature has chosen to pick winners and losers in the medical marketplace and that the legislature prevented thereby our serving the Woodbury community with such a facility 5 years ago. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Lerner. Would you please repeat your first name again for the record?
Irving, I-R-V-I-N-G.
Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it. Members, any questions for the testifier? Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Lerner, they were passing out papers, and I missed something you said. You would like to see something like you. I know Cornerstone's facility in Woodbury. Is this bill totally blocking your ability to put a radiation bed at Cornerstone?
Mr. Lerner?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying about Cornerstone, but the bill says that Health East can establish a new radiation therapy facility in Woodbury. We applaud that as serving the community as we had proposed 5 years ago to do. We are only concerned that the legislature is picking winners and losers. But for the citizenry of Woodbury, this is a good thing and we applaud it.
Representative Kiefer.
Follow-up. Okay, so my question is, if Minnesota Oncology still wants to put their bed in the Cornerstone facility, will they be able to, or is this 7-mile restriction prohibiting you to do that?
Yeah, Dr. Lerner.
The 7-mile restriction would clearly prevent us from doing that, but in addition to that, we would have no interest in doing that. We have no interest in putting up a facility that doesn't have a real need. And so we're supportive of the study, which will show genuinely where there is need in this community and where there is not.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Members, any other questions? Seeing none, Chair Hamilton, are there any other testifiers that you're aware of that need to testify? Yeah.
That need to testify?
That was the question. That was the question.
You know, Mr. Chairman, this bill, Representative Anderson, Bruce had the bill that did the exact opposite of what mine did. And I was told that was up in HHS reform today, just now. And this exact same amendment went on Representative Anderson's bill as well. So, like I said, I believe we found peace in the valley. As the fine doctor, yes, there's another testifier here, as the fine doctor said, they do have some concerns, and I think you're going to hear that from everybody on all sides of this issue. But I believe they're also accepting the terms of this agreement.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Chairman Hoppe.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hamilton, I think that Chair Sanders said it well, and we certainly don't want to discourage people from testifying. And I know that everybody, and Mr. Sachs, please feel free to testify. I'm not saying it specifically, but we know a lot of work went into this, and we know a lot of people don't like it a little bit, and maybe some people don't like it more. And again, we do appreciate the fact that everybody got together and worked on this. And if there are people that want to come and testify on, you know, from either side, please feel free. We weren't, you know, I appreciate the effort in light of the time, and we don't need to hear from people, but don't feel like, you know, you're not welcome to come and testify. Okay. So, Mr. Sec, please.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to that point, I guess I asked the members if they would, just to say yes, there was peace in the valley, just to get it on record. They could probably do that in 15 seconds or less.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sec. Please identify
yourself.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Representative Hamilton wanted me to come up and tell you that my name is Jerry Sec, representing Minneapolis Radiation Oncology, and we agreed to the deal. 13 seconds.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sec. We greatly appreciate it.
Anybody else?
Anyone else that would like to say a brief word on this issue? Seeing none rush down, members, any questions? Seeing none, we'll move to a vote on the DE2. Is that correct? That Representative or Chairman Hoppe moved. All in favor of the DE2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Chair Hamilton, any final words?
No.
greatly appreciate that.
I just appreciate all sides coming to the table and work on this. There's been a lot of controversy around this issue as well. Members, I ask for your support so we can move this on.
Thank you, Chair Hamilton. Chair Hoppe, to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will renew my motion on House File 383 as amended, be recommended, passed, and sent to the General Register.
So moved. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton, and thank you, everybody that came here to speak and observe. With that, next bill on the agenda, Representative Sanders. Representative Sanders, since you brought it up, we were very much hoping you follow Mr. Sec's example. 13 seconds, sounds good.
Kick and do it in 12 minutes. There, kick.
Representative Sanders, if you want to go ahead and move House File 2732, work on the bill.
Chair, I will move House File 2732, be recommended to pass, sent to the General Register. I also have an A1 amendment, if it's okay with the committee, to adopt the amendment to put it in the shape that I wish. This is what gives us the all-important peace in the valley on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Sanders, and I think we're fine adopting that. Is everybody okay with adopting the amendment?
Yes.
and I haven't found it yet. Was it the DE?
I have the A1.
The A1 amendment. Sorry. Well, any questions to the A1 amendment, members? Seeing none, those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Sanders to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 2732 lessens the burden of occupational licensing for satellite installers in this state. Compliance with the current licensure requirement creates hardship for small businesses and the satellite carriers involved in the sale and installation of satellite television in Minnesota by requiring them to have a limited power license. The exam criteria is for the limited power license covers material that has absolutely nothing to do with installing a satellite dish on a residential dwelling. It includes things such as swimming pools, fire alarms, outdoor lighting, refrigeration, air conditioning, central heating, all of those, again, far out exceeding what's necessary for satellite installation. With the amendment and specifying again that this is for residential dwellings only, it is supported by the Satellite Communications and Broadcasting Association, and again with the amendment, the Department of Labor and Industry and the IBEW are neutral on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Representative Nelson, you have a question? I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Sanders, is Representative Mahoney good with this? Have you talked to him about this?
Mr. Chair, to that point, I have not heard from anyone that has a problem personally with this bill.
Okay. I was just checking. I have spoken to him about this. I couldn't remember if it was this bill or not. It is going from here to the Jobs Committee. Representative Mahoney will give it his blessing or not there. So, but it's my understanding. I think he's good with the bill. So,
with the amendment.
Amended. Yes. Members, any questions? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak for or against the bill?
This is the
point. Seeing nobody rush down, come on down.
And the electricians have been okay with the amendment.
We're okay with people that hide behind the state flag here. Sir, if you could please identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Chairman, members, representatives of the committee, my name is William Brown, spelled B-R-A-U-N. I hold two occupational licenses from the state of Minnesota. I'm a power limited technician. I also hold a license as a firefighter in Minnesota. I actually am here today because I watched the Senate testimony with misinformation that was being spread to the committee, and that brought me here. I'm a member of CARSA, Communication Alarm and Remote Signaling Association. We help draft the current legislation. Beyond that, I actually go in buildings that are on fire to save lives and property. This bill concerns me quite a bit because of the change in experience requirements for installation. The misinformation that was being spread in the Senate hearings were that there's a hardship in getting a license currently in Minnesota. In Minnesota, there's over 10,000 people that have gotten the specific license required for this installation. The license simply requires that one person, just one person at the company, have at least 3 years of experience and get this license. And then everyone at the company can install. So Dish Network or EchoStar or DirecTV, if one person has the license, hundreds and hundreds of installers, employees, can be all working under that one license. When we decide that the minimum experience requirement for doing this type of life safety work, and this is what it is National Fire Protection Association Code, National Fire Protection Association Code 70, a life safety code, NFPA, referred here as the National Electric Code, is a life safety code. This is the thing that keeps firewalls, it stops fires from spreading through houses. This is the thing that keeps smoke from asphyxiating people. These are the things that protect firefighters and determine how fast buildings collapse. Things have to be done to code or they become dangerous. Now, we're talking about occupations that when the house is built, an inspector comes in and looks at all the work and checks the fire stopping and fire blocking. And I did some research after I watched the committee hearings, and I went out and I took the DirecTV training class for a new installer. It's online. I took the training class, and it tells me that there's fire blocks, and it tells me how to get rid of those fire blocks. It says nothing about how to restore the fire blocks. It tells me about firewalls, and it tells me how to put holes through firewalls, but it tells nothing about how to restore those firewalls. I'm so concerned that the testimony in the Senate said that all the employees need personal licenses, but that's very untrue. What we're asking is that an employee who's out installing, when they run across something that's unusual, like a hazardous location, someplace that's actually dangerous, that they have someone else at the company they can call who has a minimum of experience, 3 years. And we went through the testimony when the current law was passed, that 3 years of experience was not onerous for someone to gain that. And now we are taking away from the Department of Labor the ability to certify this class. By the way, the class that statute that the legislature is now saying completely qualifies you to do these installations is a class you can complete online. It's a one-day class. A one-day class. It is bad language in this legislation that without real consultation has come through. And had we known about it in the Senate, we would have come over and testified it in the, you know, in the Senate hearing. You know, we add a new amendment that now we're just dealing with residences. We're dealing with where people sleep, where they're asleep, or if there's a fire where they're sleeping. Now, in a commercial building, at least you're awake and you're around, and if you see a fire, you can leave. When you're asleep, if there's a fire, you are so much more limited in what your options are. So, you know, the residential building, like other statutes in Minnesota, limited to one and two family dwellings. Here we can be dealing with multifamily dwellings, 3 stories, 5 stories, 10 stories, 14 stories. People trapped in high-rise buildings without the ability to escape because firewalls have been penetrated vertically through the structure. And I'm not sure which technical people worked on this, but I went to the website of this course, the Satellite Broadcast Communication Industry, that's listed in here, and they say that this training class is to be used in conjunction with a formal training class. I don't want to say almost speechless. Yeah. I'm surprised that a bill gets this far without someone going to the website that we are now mandating in statute to be reviewed. So, in summary, this bill is unnecessary. One person, there's 10,000 people out there. A company just has to hire one of them, and all their installers can do all the work at all the places they need. We do not need additional licensing. That the National Standards and Testing Program for its highfalutin term is a one-day class that doesn't actually even talk about the code. It mentions, well, you should ground. That the limits of work in this residential, that you can be working on a 14-story high-rise, you can be removing the fire stop between each layer of that. And as a firefighter, I find that personally dangerous. That is not addressed in this legislation. And finally, we're dealing with systems that have a lack of inspection. When they're installed, when construction is new, but we're talking about people who go out there, there's no inspector, there's no one looking over their shoulder, there's no one going to be looking and saying, wow, that's a good inspection. Because this is a historic industry where we've had problems. When the Department of Labor and Industry went out and did their surveys, they found a third of the installations as dangerous. Dangerous installations. Ungrounded, a lightning strike is 30,000 amps of power. And these systems are ungrounded. You're talking about people putting big metal things on top of houses where lightning strikes down, and they're ungrounded. And now we are going to say that, well, no experience is exactly the right amount of experience for safely installing these systems in Minnesota, when that isn't even in conformance with the Satellite Broadcast Communication Association's own website about these training classes. I'm highly concerned, and what brought me down here today...
Hey, Mr. Braun, I'm going to interrupt you only because we have a number of questions, and I think you'll be able to cover some of the things and move us along here. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, mine is for Representative Sanders, so I can...
Okay, I could have been wrong. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, would be concerned about inspection. However, this is what's defined as low voltage and is under a low voltage license at the present time. But you lost me when you got into firewalls and satellite dishes. What's the correlation between the person that comes and puts up your DirecTV dish, climbs up there, and in my case, he came 5 minutes before it was pitch black, and there he is on a ladder and two stories up. But seriously, I don't get the connection between the dish, the low voltage power, and firewalls.
Mr. Braun.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, if I can explain, a house or a residence is a system of systems, and they're all interconnected and they all work together. That dish is an antenna. The antenna sits on top of the house. To get between that antenna and the inside of the house, there's cabling that runs through. A house is constructed of a series of firewalls or fire stops or fire blocks that, in a fire emergency, will contain the fire to a part of the house for a period of time so that firefighters can arrive, so that people have time to evacuate. It limits the spread of smoke, which is really the deadly part of fires, and it limits the spread of fire. When these cables are being installed, and according to the installation instructions that they're giving, they are having these firewalls penetrated. They are drilling holes through these things to put in telephone cable, to put in network cable, to put in coaxial cables to interconnect these systems. And that is reducing the effectiveness of the firewalls that were originally designed to the systems and installed per the codes that the legislature has mandated.
Representative Anzels, does that answer your question?
Sort of, but just as an aside, you know, where I live, and if there's a fire, all they save is the lot.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this bill is in response to a lot of, you know, a lot of the issues and problems that came out, the issues that Dolly found. We worked with Dolly on this bill. We've worked with the Board of Electricity. You got to remember here, these satellite dishes are installed for residential owners to put up. There's no requirement in law that these have to be put up. I mean, there's no requirement. I mean, a residence owner could put this up themselves. This is how they are designed to be put in. So what we're saying here is that we want them to be trained and be trained safely and to the standards that the Department of Labor and Industry has. And installed by the correct and right person who has been trained. But they also don't need to be trained on swimming pools and heating and air conditioning, which is what they currently have to be trained under. And again, supported by the Satellite Communications and Broadcasting Association, Dolly and IBEW are neutral on this and worked with the Board of Electricity. So I mean, we can work on some firewall language if that helps mitigate some things in the Jobs Committee. I don't know if we'll be ready in time to put language on there, but possibly in the floor as well. But again, until just now, I was not aware that anyone had any issues on the issue because of all the different parties who had agreed on the language.
Representative Dowd, and then Representative Anderson has a question for you, Representative Sanders. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, you mentioned the satellite companies having 10,000 installers. I'm interested in where you're getting that information. That hasn't been my experience. When I call the satellite company to come out and install something at my house, they send a local contractor that comes out to do it, and I would assume that company has, you know, a dozen or so installers. So I'm where are you getting the 10,000 installer information?
Mr. Braun.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, the 10,000 number is the number of people that the state of Minnesota has licensed in the state already to be doing these installations or to supervise these installations. So there are 10,000 people that, if any company would like to do satellite installations, if they hire any one of these 10,000 people, that one person works for the company, then every single employee, all 10 employees, can be doing installations under that one person's license.
Thank you, Mr. Braun. Representative Dowd.
So you're not suggesting that DirecTV or Dish Network can have nationwide 10,000 installers with only one person that's licensed supervising everybody that does those installations in the state of Minnesota? I mean, that's not really the way it works.
Mr. Braun.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, under statute, yes. If Dish Network had one person with a Minnesota license, they could get a Minnesota license, and then any of their employees in the state of Minnesota could make those installations.
Representative Dowd.
Again, back to the last part of my question, that's not really the way it works, though. Dish Network does not do installations themselves, right? I know they don't at my house. They have a contractor that does it.
Mr. Braun.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, they're trying to get around time and hour laws they're trying to take employees and not have them paid on the clock, so they're all subcontractors. They're not actually, what they're trying to do is not have employees, and so by using subcontractors, the contractor doesn't work for the company, and thus Dish Network, EchoStar, doesn't have to comply with wage and hour laws. And
Mr. Braun, that's what we call here a jobs issue.
Chairman, answering the question.
I know, and you're doing a great job of testifying and answering all the questions. Representative Anderson, and please stay there, but Representative Anderson has a question for the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Sanders, the way I understand it, there is no means for inspecting any of this work that is done. Is that correct?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, to my understanding, it would be under the Department of Labor and Industry, and whatever their rules and guidelines that currently exist in statute would be what would govern how inspections are done.
Sure.
Representative Anderson.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, myself, I could go and install my own satellite, and I wouldn't have to get a license, be a licensed electrician at all, and there would be nobody to actually inspect my work. Isn't that correct?
Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chair, that's correct as I understand it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Cook, did you want to come and talk about the bill?
Mr. Chairman, only if it's necessary, I could answer questions, but if you're ready to vote.
Members, do we have any questions? And Mr. Braun, thank you. You did a very nice job of testifying. I think what we're going to do is send the bill to the Jobs Committee, and if you can get together with Representative Sanders and anything you guys can work on, I'm sure he would love to have the input. Is there anyone else in the crowd that wants to speak for or against this bill?
Don't know.
Seeing no one, Representative Sanders, do you want to renew your motion that House File 2732, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the Committee on Jobs?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think I have to amend my motion, but my motion will be to recommend passage of House File 2732 be sent to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development.
As amended. Representative Sanders renews his motion that House File 2732, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the Committee on Jobs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
Thank you.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Members, we're going to, I don't know where we are on our agenda, but we're going to have Representative Atkins come in and come up and talk about everybody's favorite, the omnibus liquor bill. And I apologize to those that are here for other bills that we're not going to get to this evening. We're going to try to figure out when we have to come back. I'm personally hoping it's not tomorrow night, but we'll see about schedules and room availability. And with that, Representative Atkins, if you want to go ahead and move 2784, which will become the omnibus liquor bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 2784 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. And then, Mr. Chair, there is a delete all. It's the DE3. I'd move that. That'll put it in the shape with which the author would like to proceed.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Atkins moves the It is the DE3 amendment, correct?
Yes.
The DE3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The DE amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Atkins, to the bill as amended.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a very serious bill. I don't mean to give it short shrift, but I recognize the time constraints of the committee, and I'll move through it rapidly. First section is the bulk wine provision. That was my bill. You'll recall Mr. Rockler raised a couple of concerns about it. With Mr. McCormick's help, we've addressed those concerns to make sure that it's blended, imported bulk material, and it's within the 49% currently allowed. The next section, Section 2, addresses future farm wineries that require that they actually be on farms and ag property. You'll recall that item came up in committee. The next item is the wine educator license at Section 3. It's Representative Kiefer's bill, and there's agreement from all involved on the language there. The section after that would be Section 4. That's Representative Simon's bill regarding clothing, as is Section 5 regarding tastings, both of which were non-controversial in committee pursuant to the testimony. Representative Gunther's bill is Section 6. That's the Winnebago exemption. And again, we've got peace in the valley with respect to that. Representative Maury Lanning's Section 7 addresses the Blue Stem Center for the Arts. Again, non-controversial. Section 8 is Representative Champion's item regarding the Kix Liquor store that was hit by the tornado in Minneapolis. We just heard that testimony yesterday. And then the final provision is Section 9. That's simply a revisor's instruction, a technical change. What's not in the bill, Mr. Chairman? First item is the A2 amendment. It was your bill. It was up today. Obviously, we couldn't include it in the bill without having it first heard and laid over. Mr. Chairman, if you'd like to move the A2 amendment, since it's your bill, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. I will move the A2 amendment, and would, even though we just heard it a couple hours ago, I would stand for any questions on it. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The A2 amendment is adopted. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It bears noting that the Wine Festival, your A2 amendment bill, did make the deadline in Senate and is in the Senate's bill. There's two other provisions that are not in the bill. One was heard last year in this committee. It was primary source. The other one is heard this year. It's multiple licenses. They did not make, neither provision made deadline in the Senate. Neither provision made it into the Senate's bill. And as I understand it, just from sort of informal conversations with members of the committee, is that there's not significant support for either of those. But speaking solely for myself, I expect to continue looking at and have talked with Mr. McCormick about getting a little bit more information in the interim about each of these. And in fact, the grocers were kind enough to provide some additional information. The primary source folks have been helpful. So I don't think these issues are going away. I also would give deference to the committee's wishes if you want to try to put them in the bill. I consider myself, by the way, and I should have said it at the outset, more of a vessel for this bill than a chief author. A growler, perhaps, might be the most appropriate term, but I really feel a responsibility to the other authors. These are important bills to them and to their constituents, so I do my best to put together a bill that we can generate a decent amount of support for. With that in mind, Mr. Chairman, I do have an A6 amendment, which is relative to the TCF stadium situation at the University of Minnesota. This is a late-breaking compromise. I will understand, certainly, if the committee has misgivings about this, but I've run it by some members, not everybody, I apologize, but I've tried to run it by members on both sides of the table and have gotten, I think, a good amount of support and understanding for it. For quick background on it, Mr. Chairman and members, when the TCF Stadium was built, the university intended to simply serve alcohol in the suites. The House and the Senate, mostly the House, had some, shall we say, discomfort with that and wanted there to be, since there was all this public money that was put into it, that there would in fact be beer available to people down in the bowl, in the public seats as well as in the... So we've tried a number of times to find a compromise. It's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, that this compromise works for the university. I think the question is, does it work for members? I would start by moving the A6 amendment, Mr. Chair, so you can take that up, and then I'll give a little bit of the detail, and we'll just see what sense members have for the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. And I think maybe the first thing we should do, the A6 amendment is before us. Representative Dowd, do you want to speak to this? Otherwise, I think we could go to... I don't know, somebody over there who's been rather passionate about this issue for a few years. Representative Dowd.
I would like to speak to it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is something that I have visited quite a bit with both Representative Atkins, Representative Lilly, and yourself, Mr. Chairman. Although I would like to see us just remove the restriction and allow the university to do whatever it is that they want to do. I do appreciate everybody's efforts here, and I wanted to thank all those people who have worked on this, because I think this is moving in the right direction, so I do support this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Dowd. Representative Lilly, are you ready?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins. It's no secret, it's something I've been interested with, and many of folks around the table have helped on this, and it's really quite an interesting subject when you get into it as far as what other stadiums around this country are doing and whatnot. I was just wondering if Mr. Atkins, or Representative Atkins, if you had an opportunity to if you could just clarify what it means exactly in the stadium, and then just that would just give me a little more comfort. But I'm actually excited about it. I think it's a reasonable approach, and Representative Dowd has been kind of rattling the tree, so you got to give him credit. And I think, you know, with the football stadium as it is, it's I mean, it's no secret to me. I thought about it a lot the other day when Creasel's bill was up, and you know, a lot of it is they're pretty similar. It's kind of a Joe Average thing, and you know, a lot of people are sneaking beer in there now. And if you study this issue, it's really fascinating. It's actually eliminates some of that sneakage in, and people are, you know, you're not making criminals out of them for what many people are doing anyways. But I don't know how much comment you wanted. I could go on for a little while.
That was perfect, Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Atkins.
Here's what the proposal is, and there's a little bit of cleanup because the amendment literally was drafted by Mr. McCormick at 12:30 this afternoon after some efforts to try to figure out. But so the U has a couple little tweaks to it that don't change the substance of it. But what's being proposed right now under current law, the most recent effort to solve this issue. Would have allowed for required that the university allow for service of beer or alcohol in 1/3 of the general seating, and if assuming that they did that, then they could serve as much as they wanted to in the suites, subject to, you know, good reason and good sense. For various reasons, that proved to be impracticable for the university. What the new language would provide for is that they would designate an area within the stadium where which would be convenient to the general public to go down and purchase beer rather than at every vending window or every concession window within the stadium. What's been discussed is something more of a beer garden as you enter the stadium on the west side of the building,
the open end of the bowl.
There's an open end of the towards the end zone on the east side that would be akin to a beer garden. That would be where it would be available. The public would have access to that and be able to buy a beer. There is a couple of items of cleanup language, Mr. Chairman, if I can incorporate. And it's a little bit more than I like to do, but it's kind of a work in progress. So on line 1.19 would change the word after stadium from or to and.
That would be line 1.19 after the word stadium. Get rid of the word or and put in and.
Right.
Okay.
And then on next page, line 2.8, in the underlined language, after the word at, would insert the word a and change the word locations into location, singular. Thus defining, again, it's a single beer garden. So we've got at a location.
Then, Representative Atkins, I think then on line 2.9, we need to change R to is.
And that was my next change, Mr. Chairman.
I just wanted to be half a step ahead.
The grammar, is very impressive. also, Mr. Chair, I'm still in line 2.8 after the word location, though. It would say in the stadium. Representative Lilly noted that my language was not tight enough. It could have actually been served outside of the stadium. At this point now, I'd say that provides for the sale of intoxicating liquor at a location in the stadium that is convenient to the general public attending, and then rather than event, it would say intercollegiate football game. That's been the target of this legislation,
Representative Atkins, if I know we're kind of doing this on the fly here, but if we change that to intercollegiate football game instead of event, is that the university's intention that it doesn't impact concerts or things like that? Do they want to strictly keep this to football?
That is their desire, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if that's the House's desire or this committee's desire, where I was going to,
there,
Mr. Chairman, maybe what we should do is there's one other location that will not be controversial, and then if we can come back to the event versus okay. Intercollegiate football game. And this is the final change. On line 2.10, after the word available, insert the words at that location. Those are all clarifying points, Mr. Chairman. The one item that may be contentious, however, is event versus intercollegiate football game. And we do have Mr. Iverson, who can perhaps explain what their concern is with respect to that one item.
Well, while Mr. Iverson is getting settled, Representative Atkins, how is this going to impact the ability for the university to sell alcohol? And maybe, Mr. Iverson, you can shed some light on this, or offer alcohol at Mariucci Arena and Williams Arena and other events like that. Mr. Iverson.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Todd Iverson, representing the University of Minnesota. To answer your question first, and then I'll go to the events issue, this language would allow us to sell alcohol in the club room in Mariucci and in the boxes in Williams Arena. On the event versus the intercollegiate football game, I think if you read, and Mr. McCormick can correct me if I misspeak, but if you read the way the language reads today, it is strictly focused at intercollegiate football games, and the restrictions are around that. We have a license for TCF Bank Stadium outside of intercollegiate games, and we're happy with the way that license is operating and don't want to interfere. And just so the committee understands, for most concerts, we are a landlord and will rent the venue to the promoter. And it is their decision with a caterer's permit or other suggestions, where we would utilize our liquor license in most cases is when we rent the stadium for a wedding or a celebration of some sort where we are the owner of the facility. So
okay.
I hope that clarifies things.
It does. Thank you, Mr. Iverson. Members, do we have any questions about the oral amendments? Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and members, and testimony, I guess that's kind of goes to the principle, I guess, of the whole entire thing for the other stadiums. I guess I'm disappointed that we're not making us the same reasonable solution, which the university seems open to for the other facilities. I would just argue that we're making a great effort, as is you, in compromising and offering a solution to fix the Gopher football stadium, but at the same time we're going to continue a situation in which folks won't be able to share a beverage, or if you're in a box situation you can and you can't in different places. And I think that's unfortunate. I don't know what if I stand alone on that, but I think that's, you know, I think the House had a very strong position on the entirety of that, and I guess I find that disappointing.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I actually, once we got through the proposed amendment language to the amendment, I wanted to raise that issue myself. I don't know what the preference of, literally just didn't have time to run that by people, but the 2 points that I would make. Number one is that when we brought this issue up, the target was TCF Stadium. We didn't even think about, until after it occurred, the impact that it would have on Mariucci and elsewhere. That's not to say I disagree with Representative Lilly. I'm just saying that when we were talking about it, the entire House floor debate was about what was happening or not happening or allowed to happen at TCF. Number two, though, as if it is this committee's desire or the House generally or the legislature's, it's a very simple change to take out on line 1.22 the deleted language, or it would be undeleting where it says an arena or. It would, wouldn't be much of a tweak in my sense, Representative Lilly, is that on the floor, I'm guessing that this is going to be the kind of issue that probably does come up. And it's, you know, it's the kind of thing where it is an issue that is one for the entire body, but I do think that it would be make some sense for this committee to lay the groundwork for that debate by doing this amendment. If you have comfort, we at least take the discussion about 90% of the way there and then leave the remaining 10% for the entire body to decide on in terms of should it apply to all of the venues, simply to TCF, or what would be the desire of the body. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll...
Representative Lilly, do you want to respond to that? And then we have Representative Dowd and Mullery.
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I rarely disagree, but I think it's probably better to deal with it here and go the other direction and add it back in, I guess, would be my preference.
Well, Representative Mullery, to that point?
Chair, definitely. I think we do what Representative Lilly does. And just from a practical, and I'm not going to be one, I've got season tickets at basketball, but I'm probably not going to have them after now. You have to pay another $400 to sit where I seat, but seat where I sit. But it's also, the lines now are getting backed up because of people searching the things, and people are bringing in their own and little finding new ways to get around the searchers and things like that. It's a lot, I think, actually better to have it served actually there. People are actually drink more responsibly when it's served there than when they're bringing in straight high test alcohol.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my concern is to the author, the at a location that is in the stadium, the verbal amendment. I just want to ensure that that does not, and Mr. McCormick has said that this does not limit them from selling it in the boxes. I want to make sure that the university is able to do the boxes in addition to this other site. And I guess I'm just offering an opportunity for anybody to say that or say that that's exactly what is allowed here.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, but Mr. McCormick might be he's nonpartisan staff. He doesn't have an axe in the game here, so.
Mr. McCormick?
Mr. Chairman, members, my understanding is that because the university pulls down a liquor license for TCF Stadium, and because this language limits the places a limitation on sales to the general public, that license will allow sales in the boxes as well. I think at some point, if there's a need for belt and suspenders working with the university, we could add that in, but I'm reasonably comfortable that right now that arenas, if you pass this as we've written it, you would be able to sell in the luxury boxes at arenas, you would be able to sell in luxury boxes at the stadium, and under this you would be able to provide service to the general public at a location on intercollegiate college events.
Thank you, Mr. McCormick. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just real quick to Mr. Iverson, you're okay with that language limiting it to just one location for the general public?
Mr. Iverson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
I think we're Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, I've had a chance to kind of Mullery this over a little bit here this afternoon. And what I'd offer as a suggestion is, since our timeline on this is going to be that TCS Stadium will be active this fall, that we limit it to that location so that the university can gain practical experience in the delivery and administration of this, and that this legislature will convene again in January. We can learn from that experience and then take the boxes at the other two facilities and or expand them at Mariucci and Williams Arena.
Well, Representative O'Driscoll, I think practically speaking we're doing that because they're not going to sell alcohol to the general public anywhere other than the football stadium. And so we're I don't know if we're grandfathering in, we're including Mariucci and Williams, Northrop, and other locations that the university wants where they're not, at least Mr. Iverson, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the intent is to sell it anywhere else to the general public other than at the bank.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct at this point.
Representative O'Driscoll, does that, I think I know where you're going with that. Does that answer your question?
It does at this time. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it bears noting, too, if I might, lines 2.14 and 2.15 is basically a way of saying if this doesn't work very well, the whole thing expires July 1st of 2014. So it's going to come back to see how this is all going. And me and Mr. Iverson, if we're still both around, and you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dowd, Lilly, and others that want to be involved in it. It gives us a chance to kind of see how it goes and make some changes if need be. So,
well, Representative Atkins, I was going to note that, and thank you. And the other thing I was going to say is in regard to what Representative Lilly said, I understand what you're saying and wanting to have beer available for the general public and the other venues. Let's see how this goes. And I think the reason that we were focusing on, and Representative Atkins mentioned that when we were originally talking about this, it was only the bank, and it was because it was new and it was going to be started. But it's also the biggest venue, will impact the most people, and frankly will have the biggest impact to the U's bottom line, which, I mean, whatever our stance on beer at the game or games, I think we all want to try to do everything we can to help Coach Kill and President Kaler. And I think that's why, and I'm with you on the spirit of it. But let's see how this goes, and we can you can certainly revisit this. We, the rest of us might not be here, but. Members, any other questions? Representative Nelson, thank sorry.
You. I'm just thinking of practicality, having in the past with supporting my son's scout troop. So having worked at the Metrodome serving beer.
No, Representative Nelson, we can't have the Cub Scouts sell beer at the stadium.
But I put their scout troop selling beer at the Metrodome,
yeah.
Manning a food booth. Is one location going to be practical and one beer garden going to be practical? I'm thinking of the massive amount of people, and I guess it's just more for Mr. Iverson and maybe coming back in 2014 looking at this. It's
Mr. Iverson or Representative Atkins, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that this is going to be a fairly good-sized area, and I would be shocked if there's only one small counter where people can get served. And I think what one of the things that might happen, and Mr. Iverson might disagree, Mr. McDonough might disagree too, but I think they might find out that this is something that the fans like and actually is a nice revenue enhancer for the stadium, and they might come back to us in 2014 and, you know, revisit the issue. Comment and well taken. Representative Atkins or Mr. Iverson, do you want to shed some light on that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson, I can honestly tell you that this is still in the very early formative stages of development, and we will put a lot of thought into this and make it one of the goals of TCF Bank Stadium is to have a great experience while you're there, and we will do everything to ensure that our fans have a great experience in every aspect of their game day experience. So I think that we will do everything we can to make this work as well as we possibly can.
Thank you, Mr. Iverson. Representative Dowd.
I'm wondering if Representative Atkins would consider supporting an amendment that would make parking also convenient to the general public at the stadium.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, you know, just keep in mind that, you know, the Gopher Stadium has there's 50,805 seats. So some of what Representative Nelson's saying is, you know, you're going to have one tent. There's 39 suites and 100 or 59 boxes. I don't know exactly this. And then like 300 club seats. So you're only probably talking a couple thousand seats versus the 50,000. So you're going to have 48,000 people or 45,000 people trying to get to one tent. So just kind of keep that in mind. I, you know, yesterday I didn't get up, and, you know, I don't get up on the floor and do very much shenanigans, but I'm gonna make a motion to do an amendment. I just think this is the place to do it. And on line 1.22, I want to remove the words an arena. Is that
an arena or?
Okay, and or.
You might reinstate.
I guess.
You mean undelete?
Undelete, rather. Thank you very much.
Instate.
My intent, maybe just to start off, is to include the other arenas. So yes, on the line 1.22. And then on the next page, after, on lines 2.6, after the TCF stadium, to add the other stadiums. So my intent is to have the same thing available in the other stadiums. It just seems fair and reasonable to me that when everybody goes to a stadium, including the hockey games, that they can be able to have a barley pop if they want one, and not just the people in the suites. So,
Representative Atkins,
just Mr. Chair, what I realized is that in order to make it work, you'd still need more language, and I'm seeing Mr. McCormick nodding his head. Under the in lines 2.8 through 2.11, you'd need more about where the location would be at Ritter, or where the location would be at Mariucci, or where it would be at the baseball field, or wherever, what other any other venues that we're talking about. So it would be a little bit challenging, I think, to do it in committee. My guess, Representative Lilly,
I withdraw the amendment at this point.
It's going to be an amendment on the House floor no matter what, right?
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Anderson. Members, any other questions? Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair, an hour's late, so I just, on the record, have to register my objection to Section 3 on the wine educator thing, and I'd be happy to talk with you after the bill offline, but I just have some real problems with that, so
okay.
Just wanted to let you know.
Thank you, Representative Loon, and please talk to Representative Atkins, and I'd be happy to be part of that conversation, too. And so at this point, does anyone in the audience want to come down and speak for or against the, I guess we're calling it the oral amendment? Did we adopt the A6 amendment? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I incorporated some oral amendments that
into the A6 amendment.
Into the A6, so it's the A6 that's before you.
Okay. So does anybody want to come down and speak to the A6 amendment? Seeing nobody come down, we will vote on the A6 amendment as orally amended by the author. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A6 amendment is adopted. Representative Atkins, to the bill as amended. Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chairman, I have just a technical amendment. It's on the DE3 amendment, page 4, line 17. I'm going to have us remove the word act and insert the word section.
So that is page...
Page 4, line 17.
Oh.
The word act should be taken out, the word section should be put in.
Got it. Members, does everyone have that change? Seeing no questions, can we just incorporate that as a technical amendment, Mr. McCormick? Okay. We already voted on the amendment. Any other questions to the bill as amended? Okay. Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the oral amendment.
Representative Sanders moves the oral amendment to the bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The oral technical amendment is approved. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Is there anyone else that wants to come down and speak for or against the bill as amended? Members, any final questions? Seeing none, Representative Atkins renews his motion that House File 2784, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Atkins. Thank you, members, for your patience. We will get back to everybody when we can meet again. And with that, we are adjourned.